This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Star Trek Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as he is every single week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how are you doing this week?
Chris, doing well. It is starting to be something like fall here in Texas, so that means the windows are open and the cicadas are still chirping, though, as if it's summer. But it's nice. It gets, you know, cooler during the evenings, and I'm liking it, so hopefully it'll continue to bring that fall weather, because that's my favorite time of year, but we don't really have fall here, so.
No, you don't. Yeah. Same for me. We've passed the cicada stage now, and I think we're into the cricket stage, so I'm very pleased about that. But Matthew, I'm really happy this week to tell everyone that we do have a guest with us, and it is friend of the show, John Tenuto, friend of the network, I should say. John's on a lot of our shows these days. John, how are you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks, guys.
Good. We're glad to have you with us, and we wanted to have you with us because we're going to talk about Cisco, and I know that you don't necessarily like people's hats, but you do like Cisco.
Yes, I love Cisco. I love Avery Brooks. I love listening to him talk in real life, and I love listening to him talk on the show. So, it's all about the Cisco.
And the particular topic tonight is going to be the episode Waltz. Now, we generally don't do episodes per se on The Orb. You know, we're more of a broad discussion show. But this particular episode is a very important one for Cisco and for Dukat and their relationship. And we talk about on here often this idea of whether or not Dukat is a megalomaniac, or is he justified in what he does, which some fans say he is. You know, there are different views on Dukat, but the writers themselves have been pretty clear on what they were doing with the character. I thought it would be interesting to discuss this particular episode because it's, unlike a lot of Star Trek episodes, this one really is like a stage play. Almost, you've got a stage, which is this cave, and you've got Avery Brooks, and you've got Mark Lamo, and it's, I think, a fantastic performance, a fantastic episode. But Matthew, why don't you lead us into this and talk a little bit about this relationship, which has been building up to this point, and then what we see of Dukat in this episode?
Well, it's something that's really interesting because, you know, the episode, it just starts off with Cisco walking on, well, the Defiant, but it's not really the Defiant. It's just right. The sets that
it's the Honshu.
Exactly. Yeah. Which looks just like the Defiant, strangely enough. What's interesting is he's having this whole conversation in his mind about, you know, whether he should really go see him, Dukat, in the first place, and he's been kind of avoiding it, and he makes that revelation, which is kind of a huge revelation for a Starfleet captain to say, I kind of wish this dude was dead. And then he says, but that's not becoming a Starfleet officer. He realizes the negativity that he's bringing to this. And, you know, from the very beginning of the episode, Cisco himself is trying to be quite fair to Dukat, giving him, very much the benefit of the doubt, being very diplomatic, trying to live up to the best of Starfleet ideas, which is that you are innocent until proven guilty, even though I think we could all agree Sisko in his mind is thinking there's no way he's not because of what he's seen. So, and that's a big part of what's been building, and it's played really well, even just at the beginning of the episode when they have that face to face in that brig and they're having that conversation, and it's just kind of laced with all of these, you know, Dukat still, you're not quite sure what he is yet in this episode. Is he really kind of, is there any kind of reform that's happened to him? Is he just the same old guy? Is he crazier than ever? And as I like to I think about it, I just used one of the old episode or the other episode titles, but you know, is Dukat sick or is it just the changing face of evil? And I think, you know, that's what we see really in this episode is really the changing face of evil, which is Dukat is always finding a way to be able to get to a point where he can justify himself, that he can justify all of his actions, and he's really not responsible for the evil he's had to do, whether it's evil or not. It's irrelevant. He's been backed into a corner, and yeah. So
right,
it's just a really interesting thing because you're watching a character rebuild, I think, his ability to justify who he is to himself, and he's right. Therefore then trying to get Sisko to be able to recognize that, because it really
he wants validation from Sisko,
exactly, because it really comes down to that conversation that him and Weyoun had right before the fall and sacrifice of angels, where he says, you know, because a true victory is to make your enemy see that they were wrong to oppose you in the first place, to force them to acknowledge your greatness. And this is really what Dukat has always wanted from everyone, especially somebody like Sisko or Kira. So this is really what I see kind of playing out in this episode, is this rebuilding brick by brick for Dukat, his ability to justify his own image of himself that he's kind of lost because of what happened.
So, John, what do you think about the setup of this episode as well? And because I think it comes down to two things which are important to how you take what happens later in the episode in the caves. Like Matthew said, Sisko seems from the beginning to be trying to be fair, even though I think in his mind, of course, he's already passed judgment on Dukat. He knows who he thinks Dukat is, what kind of person he thinks Dukat is. But whether or not Sisko is trying to be reasonable and trying to be fair or not, in reality, I think impacts how the viewer takes what happens in the caves, at least prior to the point where Dukat just completely flips out. And also part of the setup is that Dukat has been under treatment by Federation doctors, I believe, you know, in preparation for being transported to stand trial for the crimes. And I've had some people question whether or not the Federation, Starfleet, has done its job in preparing him.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I when you take a look at the character kind of before this episode, I think, you know, it's something that would be worth doing, would take some time to do, you know, as an academic exercise, I guess. But, you know, I've always thought, well, here's this character. His name sounds an awful lot like Pol Pot, you know, Dukat Pol Pot. And if you really look at, I think, his arc until this episode, you know, until we get to this point in the sixth season, he exhibits certain qualities, depending on the episode, of various dictators, you know, real dictators. So, you know, you get some Pol Pot actions by him. You certainly get Hitler riffs with him. Jim Jones comes a little later after this episode, you know, with what happened in the People's Temple and the episode on when they're on Empok Nor, and, you know, Idi Amin and all that. And I think so. There's always that undercurrent of, you know, this was a dictator, a despot who, you know, did these bad things when he was in charge of Terok Nor. At the same time, they played around with that a lot. There were plenty of episodes where he bordered on heroic. I mean, there were times when you almost felt like they moved him away from being a villain. And then they would bring him back, you know, and that was, I think, one of the great things about DS9. It was never a clear cut, you know, line of who, of good, even with Sisko, right? I mean, Sisko, there's episodes where Sisko does things, and as Matt was mentioning, he's even at least thinking things that are kind of un-Starfleet. And so in, you know, through the whole, arc of this character to this point, He's sort of, to me, always schizophrenic. There's always this yin and yang with him where there's a good side and a bad side. And I think that this episode, it kind of comes to a head and they make a decision. I think the writers make a decision in this episode that we're kind of done playing with the character. They're making the commitment through the character to make him evil. And I think that's important because I think Sisko and Dukat, you know, in the best tradition of any kind of good writing, you know, the villain is a mirror, flipped mirror image of the hero, and that, you know, that's for Kirk and Khan and a whole bunch of great Star Trek, you know, the Borg and their mentality and Picard's, you know, cherishing of freedom and individuality and all that. So, you know, you get Sisko and Dukat, and they have a lot in common with each other. You know, they both have played the same exact role on Deep Space Nine. They both lose that role and gain it again, you know, to each other. They both embrace a Bajoran religion eventually. They both start out reluctant to do so. They become the leaders of their various religions, one the Pa'Wraith religion and the other the Prophet religion. I think they both have mental collapses because Sisko, as Benny Russell anyway, has a mental collapse. And, you know, they both ultimately share the same fate, you know, again in a cave in the last episode. So you get these character parallels between the two. And at some point, though, the bad guy has to be the bad guy. And I think after sort of 6 years of dancing with this guy, I think more showing him evil than not, but dancing enough that you almost like him, even though he's, you know, horrible. And so I think that this episode, that there's this commitment by the writers and by the character that this is the path that he's going to take.
That's an interesting just a thing for Star Trek to do that, you know, Ira Stephen Baer was talking about in the Companion, that, you know, evil may be a very unkosher concept today, but it's not, even in the Star Trek world, something that's not unheard of. Like, and at the very end of the episode where, you know, Sisko says, you know, you don't really think of this idea of there being somebody who's just evil, who's the personification of it, and then you come face to face with it, and you realize that there really is this in the universe. There is this thing that's, there is a good, there is an evil, and you can make a clear distinction between the two, which is a big step for Star Trek to take. You know, it's very TOS instead of TNG. They're going to delineate between the two. You know, Kirk would always come in and he'd be the right guy, the guy on the right, and the other guys would be in the guys on the left, and you'd want to bring them to the right, you know? And so I don't mean that politically. I just mean that, you know, between good and evil. And so it's a really interesting thing to watch them do that in this episode, because it does make a clear distinction kind of between that TNG, like, we can make anybody a friend except for the Borg, you know, and even them, you know, we've got Hugh and,
eventually
they're going to be friends.
Eventually they're going to be
exactly.
friends too.
So I just think that's another great part of this episode that's kind of overhanging the whole thing of between these two, like you were talking about, John, and it's really mythic in the end.
Well, they did say that this was an intentional course correction for the character of Dukat, because, as you talked about, John, he was very much a gray character up to this point. You know, there are those times where he seems very evil, and there are those times where he does seem heroic. And to set up the conclusion of the story and where it was going, they've actually said, I believe this is also in the DS9 Companion, that they felt that the audience had possibly come to sympathize with Dukat a little bit more than they ever intended to be the case. So there was this feeling that a course correction was needed, and they really did use this story to say, no, the Cod's evil. And, you know, we've had debates with fans that he's not evil. And I think that it's for the sake of the story, what the writers want to do with the story, you know, it's their character. Their decision was that no, Dukat is representing the evil side of this battle that's going on, this sort of, you know, celestial battle. And Sisko's one side, Dukat's the other. And so here they did set it up so that he becomes a more, to me, a more two-dimensional character from here on out to the end of the series. Which I also wonder, do you feel like this hurt the character of Dukat overall? Or did it actually, taking this direction with Dukat, make the story better to the end of the series?
Well, I think there's a couple ideas there. One is, he's kind of going back to his Dukat evil. I mean, I might be the, you know, a dinosaur, and never really bought into sort of postmodern thinking. But, you know, if you kill one person alone for personal gain, that's an evil action. So, you know, he's killed many people for personal gain. So to even debate whether he's evil or not, I think is kind of the postmodern reality. And what I like about the episode is that right in the era of, you know, what is the definition of is, and you're getting plays like Wicked, which is questioning is the bad one really bad? And you're getting shows like Smallville, where Lex Luthor, is he really bad or is he good? You're getting Star Wars, right? Which is it's always been the classic, evil and good is very easy to tell the difference. And then you get the prequels, which start to blend in the idea of, well, you know, is evil really like that? You get all these sort of, you know, pre-9/11, you know, what is evil type of motifs in our culture. And Deep Space Nine kind of has the courage to go, no, there's evil, and this is what evil looks like, you know, and really sort of break out of, I think, which is a circular argument in postmodernism. So I enjoyed that part of it. In terms of the character, you know, part of the problem, I think, in that we could say it did weaken him in a way, is that I could be wrong, but I don't believe him and Sisko meet again till the last episode. So he kills Jadzia at the end of the sixth episode. But unless I'm mistaken, I don't think they have kind of a big episode together again. And he plays mostly against, you know, Kai Winn, really, you know, towards the end of the show. And then they meet in the fire caves again. So they're in a cave here and they're in a cave at the end. And although I admit I could be mistaken about that, I mean, in some ways, if you're going to play that, you need to play that to strengthen your hero too. And so Sisko never really has to deal much with Dukat. It's more like Kira deals with him and others deal with him, but Sisko doesn't. And so to make that really work, I think they should have had more Sisko-Dukat interaction that you really don't get too much of, if at all, until the very last episode. And so there, I think, it isn't that necessarily that was a bad idea. I think it may have just been a bad idea because without the interaction between the two, he stays two-dimensional. You know, and they could have made it where it was a bigger idea.
It was it was interesting, Chris. You were right. That quote's right here, and with the waltz where Bear is talking about, you know, seeing on the internet people talking about, well, he only killed 5 million people, like,
right?
Only 5 million. And he says it's just so Bear size. Like, how do you reason with somebody who can justify that kind of mass murder? And it's you really get that kind of Hitlerish mentality there. And you're not supposed to go to Hitler in an argument, but this is where Dukat went, you know, by killing that many people,
they're modeling a character after, like John said,
right, exactly,
dictators through history. So this isn't just throwing Hitler out in the middle of an argument.
Exactly.
This is actually about the character. So
I think what John said is quite true. I think that in the middle of this kind of postmodern reformation that was happening, you're getting Deep Space Nine saying, no, but remember, we've seen evil in the 20th century. It was real. It happened. And we're going to personify that in this character. And we're going to show you why it's bad and why it should be punished. You know, why it should be brought to justice. And I think that, you know, this is what transcended for me Deep Space Nine, is because from this point on, the story becomes mythology almost, not just science fiction.
Oh, yeah, and definitely.
And we've talked about that before, Chris. This story becomes, you know, just as much about the spiritual battle going on in the spiritual realm between, you know, the prophets, Pah Wraiths, Sisko, Dukat, both of them emissaries, the good, the evil happening on all sides. And I think that that's what was so interesting to see that happen, you know, Star Trek being taken out and really, honestly, put in biblical proportions. And very odd, again, for Star Trek to do that. But for me, why it's my favorite, because it allows for all of these realities, even the ones we don't see, to be at odds with each other. And it's all happening and it's all true. It just, you have to have the eyes to see it. And for me, that I think it strengthened the story that way. I can see definitely what John is saying, and I agree. It would have been great to maybe have another great Sisko Dukat confrontation before that. But you also do come down to what Sisko says at the end of the episode. It's either me or him. So you kind of know that the next time they meet, one of them's going to die. You know, waiting for that to happen, I guess they felt like they just needed to wait till the end for that to be the case.
Well, you can also look at it as, although they don't have direct confrontation with one another, there is a conflict between them behind the scenes, which I think is, it's possibly, I do agree with you, John, that I think that for me, the stories themselves that play out after this would have been more interesting if they had followed up on this and had more interaction between Dukat and Sisko. But also, it's possible that what they were doing, because, like you just said, Matthew, the biblical proportions that the show took and how they really took this conflict into good versus evil, into a spiritual realm, that the Dukat, what he's doing to assist the Pah Wraiths, knowing that Sisko is the emissary of the prophets, by pitting the Pah Wraiths and the prophets against each other, there is, in a way, a conflict going on between them post-Waltz behind the scenes. And then it all culminates when they finally meet each other once again in a cave, which you could take it as being they're in the cave together here. All of this behind-the-scenes battle goes on the celestial realm, and then it culminates when they finally meet again. They're once again in a cave.
I was thinking about what Matt was saying too. The last, if you remember the last episode of Seinfeld, you know, there's things to like about it and things not to like about it. But what I always liked about it was I always thought it was the writers saying to America, you know, what is wrong with you? Why did you like these people? They deserve to be in jail. You know, they're selfish, horrible people, and you love them, and you brought them into your home every Thursday, and you wanted to be like them, and they're just rotten people. And I love it when writers, if you can watch something and kind of think they're talking to the audience directly. And I think that idea that Matt was talking about with the quote from Ira Stephen Bear is what goes on in this episode, where, you know, you get Dukat's doing all these, what they call in sociology, techniques of neutralization, right? He's blaming the victims. It's the Bajorans' fault, what happened to them. They're prideful people. They didn't accept that we were superior and all of that. And he's, in essence, as you watch that, if you were somebody who liked him or who defended him or who said he wasn't evil, it was the writer saying to you, what's wrong with you? You know, listen to what this guy's justification is. And then Sisko kind of speaks for those who I think rightly believe this character is evil. And he said, well, you know, his responses are the responses of the, I think, of the writers. And Dukat is speaking the lines of the defenders of Dukat in that moment. And I thought that was that interplay was very interesting. I would have liked to have seen more of that kind of direct contact between, because when they're together, I think Dukat plays very well against Kira. But when he plays excellently also against Sisko. And I kind of like that interplay, and I just wish there had been more. But I think, you guys are right. You can see that them working towards that as a resolution of the story.
It's interesting to me with people who defend Dukat that it's just an observation. And again, I'm not judging, someone because they like Dukat or they try to justify what he says. But it's interesting to me that I find that the majority of people who really like Dukat and come to defend his actions, at least people I meet online, tend to be female fans. And I just wondering what that says about the character and what the character is presenting. Like you're just talking about how we come to like characters on television shows or in novels or wherever that maybe... the writers stop and say, why do you guys like these characters? And like you said earlier, Matthew, you pointed out the fact that, and this was really true, that at the time people were justifying, well, he only killed 5 million people. I don't understand how that is even a justification, even for a fictional character, that this character's not really bad because he only killed 5 million people. It almost makes you think about Picard in Insurrection when he's saying, how many people does it take before it's wrong?
Well, and that's a great reference too. I mean, because it's right in this time period when, insurrection is happening around this time. Mm-hmm. So the same kind of logic is creeping into the Federation in some ways. So that kind of Section 31 logic, that we can displace, so many people. It's fine for the greater good, which is the worst justification of, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, which is the destruction of, or the showing of that you can't just have logic without values, or logic is meaningless, because then I can logic my way into anything. In the same way, Dukat can kind of logically get himself into saying that he's just not that bad. And so, and I think what was so interesting,
he was trying to help people.
Exactly. He was trying to help the Bajorans. He was just rounding up 50 odd people so that not hundreds of thousands would have to die. Instead of actually, doing due process and making sure, not that Cardassians care about due process. So, but I think what was really interesting too, is I noticed while watching this episode, is that the characters of Kira, Weyoun, and Damar that play against Dukat are the representations of the ways that he justifies his actions to himself inside his own mind. And so they're the personification of how he talks to them, is how he can justify what he's done, and how he builds his argument with himself so that he can say that he isn't really bad. He was just doing what he had to do. And I thought that was brilliant. I had never really caught that before, but seeing that this time, I felt like it really makes the episode pop. When you realize that these are just parts of himself that he's talking to, and that's how he's kind of building this justification until he gets to that point where he's confronting Sisko and he's saying, yes, I wish they had all died. I wish I had killed them all,
right?
Because he's finally let go of the need to justify himself to anyone, even his own self. He's just gotten down to the base bit of who he is, which is, I wish I had killed them all because they weren't really worth my trouble.
There's a little moment in the episode, I don't know if it's me reading too much into things, or actually two moments that I like that are ambiguous. One is when Dukat explains what happens to the other guy who was with them when they were escaping the Han Solo, or whatever the name of the ship was.
The Honshu.
The Honshu.
The Honshu.
The island that I live on, John.
That might actually be an intentional thing right there. I think we might have just
picked up on
something.
I wonder. That would be funny. and he kind of says, he got hit with shrapnel on the head. And part of me always wondered, did he really, or did Dukat kill him? so he could be alone with Sisko and in essence try to win Sisko over, as that it appears is his original intention, you know. And I like that kind of ambiguity. They don't play it up. I mean, part of the reason I think Dukat is popular is because the acting is so good, and both of those guys are such great actors, and it's hard not to like a good performance, you know. And I think it's okay to. I mean, it's great. Everybody likes Darth Vader and Boba Fett, you know. It's okay to like the bad guy. I think as long as you recognize that he's the bad guy.
And that's the key, right? Yeah, because Dukat is a great character, especially up to this point when he is a more three-dimensional character. But you have to recognize what he's doing.
Yeah, and times when Kira even accepts, in a way, accepts him. So she's starting to open a little tiny crack of possibility that he isn't as bad as she thought. The audience could certainly do that, and I think, you know, that makes sense. The other moment I like, I don't know if I like it, but I like thinking about it, is when they rescue the two people, the other two Starfleet people that they right. think, you know, or you presume is going to be Dukat and Sisko, and they beam them up. And I never liked the O'Brien Bashir moment where they kind of look at each other like, oh, you know, it's these two people. And even like they hesitate to like help. There's like a hesitation in the doctor before he goes helps these guys. And I understand like they're thinking it's two, these other two people. They're, you know, one of them, their friend, their captain. But I always thought that they played that wrong, that I think it would have been more of the Star Trek spirit that, you know, they rescued two people. Great. You know, I'd hate to be those two guys like, oh, you're disappointed. It was me, you know. And that's another one of those moments in the episode, I think, that's just sort of there and it's ambiguous and you kind of wonder, like, why did they play it that way? And that's, I think, why DS9 is good, because they never really give you the answers, I think.
Yeah. Maybe they're just worn down by the war at that point. You know, they've been rescuing people. They've been in all these battles. They've lost so many people. And they are very, very concerned about Sisko there. They're hoping to find him. And so I don't think that it's necessarily that they're disappointed that these two people are on the ship, but, you know, they really have their hopes up. And so for a moment there, I would imagine at that point in the war, everyone is just really, really worn down by the conflict.
Yeah.
Well, and that was an interesting thing too. You have the great scene on the bridge where they're going to, Worf is ordering them to leave, to go to the Badlands. Bashir is making the classic Star Trek argument, you know, that we should stay and search. And Worf is like, you can leave the bridge, Doctor.
I know.
which I thought
now.
Was great.
I won't kill you yet.
Exactly.
I'll let you leave.
which I loved because, you know, they talked about, obviously, this is a trope that's been done in Star Trek before. And they thought, wouldn't it be great to have it turn on its head that Worf is not going to stay? He's going to do what's required of them. That the needs of 30,000 troops is more than Sisko, and even Sisko would say that too. And so I loved that there really wasn't that moral dilemma, because you can't, you know, be sacrificing, you know, thousands of people for just one at that point. And I applauded the writers for going that way. That's a great way to write, because you're expecting them to kind of do the Star Trek thing. And go save the captain, and instead Worf's nope, you know, we're gonna go and
Well, it was good growth for Worf too.
Yeah.
You know, he grew on DS9. He wasn't the static Klingon that he was, you know, Klingon wanting to be a Klingon that he was on TNG. So moving down into the caves, the big point I also want to talk about, John, at the beginning I asked you if you thought Sisko was at least attempting to be fair to Dukat. And I asked that because in the caves, now we did this episode on the Ready Room a long time ago, and there was a huge debate, and some guests that we had on were determined that from the very moment that Sisko woke up in the cave, that he was needling Dukat from the very first moment he was on screen. And the justification for that was all sorts of stuff that was not even happening in the episode. At least I don't see it happening in the episode. What was your take on this interaction with Sisko and Dukat? What do you feel? I think Dukat's goals in the episode are fairly clear, what he's doing. But as for what Sisko is doing and how he is approaching Dukat, I think it's a little bit more ambiguous of what the thought process was going on for him. How did you read this whole interaction between the two of them?
Well, I thought, you know, there's, when they were in the cave, there were sort of two things I was thinking. One answers the question. The other thing I was thinking was how, you know, there's this idea in sociology called the contact hypothesis from a researcher named Gordon Halport. The basic idea is if people are in an equal relationship with one another and have a lot of contact, they're less likely to be prejudiced about the groups that they come from because they see people as individuals. So, you know, the more educated people are, the less prejudiced they tend to be. It isn't really the education. It's spending all those years in school with people who are, you know, right, different religions or backgrounds or whatever it happens to be. So, you know, and Star Trek's done a bunch of those kinds of episodes where by two characters being forced together, they come to an understanding of each other. Like Duet, right, with Maritza and Kira, and Shuttle Pod 1 with Malcolm and Tucker, and Darmok, you know, of course, with Dathan and Picard, and, you know, and with a movie Enemy Mine, remember, with Luke Gossett Jr. and, you know, Dennis Quaid. I mean, there's all these riffs on this, and I love this episode because they do come to an understanding of each other, but it isn't the understanding of less prejudice or more understanding. It's an understanding of now I know who you really are, and now we've defined what our goals are towards one another. And it isn't that we're going to be friends. It is that we're going to be enemies with each other. And I thought that that was kind of an interesting twist on that. But I do not think that Sisko came in with that attitude. I think he was injured. He was diminished physically, so he couldn't fight back. So first of all, it'd just be stupid to antagonize a guy who could fairly easily beat you up. It doesn't make any sense from a logic point of view. I also don't think that's Sisko's nature. I mean, Sisko is a diplomat. He is, you know, intelligent. He is non-judgmental. And I think that he truly believed that, you know, this was a guy, I think he believed what he says at the beginning, that maybe this guy suffered enough, you know, like maybe that's enough suffering for a person to lose their, and especially for him, thinking about a child, you know, whether, whatever Dukat's feelings really were for his daughter, you know, Sisko loves his son, and I think he can't imagine a worse thing than that happening to a person. And so he really genuinely expresses what he thinks. It's, and in fact, I think it's telling that it's Dukat through Kira, where you're getting this, no, he's being cynical. No, he's trying to bait you. And I think eventually Sisko may move in that direction because he's realizing I need to deal with this person. He's not stable. He isn't what I thought, and he isn't stable. And then he does shift tactics a little bit, but he's certainly not antagonizing him, I don't think, at all through the episode. In fact, you know, he may be patronizing a little bit, but he is not antagonizing at all. And the patronizing becomes a, how do you deal with this person? I mean, I love when he says to him, hey, I thought we were talking, you know, like I thought we were having, what a great way to deal with him instead of going, what's wrong with you? You're crazy. He shows compassion to this guy, and I think it takes a lot to show compassion to someone like Dukat. I admire Sisko and the way he behaves in this episode. And then when they start having their final sort of battle with each other verbally, you know, Sisko lays out on the line what the argument is because of the argument that Dukat is raising. He's not raising that to
exactly,
taunt Dukat. He's raising it because Dukat is so obviously
right,
wrong about how you could, you know, to say, well, I'm not evil because I lowered the quotas of dead people by 20%. I mean, that's, you know, a strange way of thinking. And I think Sisko is right to set him, to sort of set him on a different course.
I think too, you know, when you have him wake up, he doesn't, you know, the last time that he saw Dukat was in the cell, and Dukat seemed very stable. Relatively from the, you know, the last time he had seen him in a cell where he's in the fetal position, handing him back his baseball, you know. And so I don't think Sisko has any idea what he's dealing with. And so I feel like the whole episode inside the cave is Sisko trying to figure out exactly what he's dealing with. And the whole time just trying to figure out, where is this guy? You know, and I think the moment it changes a little bit for Sisko is when he, you know, checks the comm unit and he sees it's not working. And then he tests Dukat right. to see if, you know, Dukat is telling the truth or if he's lying or if he just doesn't know. And realizes that Dukat is lying to him and keeping him there on purpose. And then his whole motive is, okay, why is he keeping me here? So Sisko finally figures that out, which is that he wants my approval, basically. And then at the last bit, I feel like Sisko is in a lot, been like a counselor this whole time. You know, counselors try to move you towards where it is they want you to go, where they can see you're going to go, but they get you to get there. Sisko does the same thing to Dukat the whole time as a counselor would, to the point where he gets Dukat to finally admit what his base nature is, which is evil. And I think that's what you really see in this episode. John, I love your reference to when he's like, you know what? Let's pretend like the Major isn't even here. Just you right. and me. It's just perfect acting by Avery Brooks, because, you know, his kind of idiosyncrasies there really come out and really strengthen that whole scene just so perfectly. Yeah. It is really well done. I agree with you. I think Sisko does the best job you can in a physically diminished state with somebody this crazy and scary and willing to do whatever it takes to get somebody to admit what he wants to hear.
You know, I don't know how much they you know, I know that they, you know, reading the guidebooks and the companion and everything, you know, there certainly was planning. But, you know, what I like about this episode is it sets up so many different elements that come for Dukat and Sakira, you know, the episode Covenant, for example. And you sort of get this setup where he despises the Bajoran people so much. And I think it shows his continued instability. So what's his answer? His answer is, I'm going to embrace one of their religions, right? I mean, it may be a cult religion, but it's still a Bajoran religion. And so I think that sort of shows his instability. And this episode really plays, you know, gives you a sense of, look, this character can't go back. Maybe there's no redemption for him, because I don't think ever in, I'm trying to remember, is there a character in the history of Star Trek that makes that admission that my hope was I killed them all and my intention is I'm going to, you know, if I can, I can't.
I don't know. Maybe Shinzon.
Yeah.
But not in the same way as this. I know what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think the only other, you know, villain that may even come close to that is the Borg, and just saying we will assimilate you all.
Well, that
but I mean, that's as close
me
as you might
they are
get. So
a mechanical hive mind.
And there's usually like another goal, right? I mean, so in other words,
right.
Thinking of someone like Shinzon or the Borg, you know, the Borg is for assimilation. So in order to assimilate, they destroy all these people. Shinzon, it's, you know, he wants to, you know, improve the power of the Romulan Empire. For Dukat, it's just to kill them. I mean, it's there's no like, to, you know, to help Cardassia anymore. There's no layering. And I think in some ways, what's really interesting in the cave is he is stripped away of everything, right? So now he has nothing. He's not going to become a legate. He's not going to become the head of Bajor again, you know. There's nothing for him. And so as his options get stripped away, we strip away all these, you know, like sort of, you know, taking wax off a table, and then you get down to the essence of what that table is. And so this is the essence of the character. And you know, it may be two dimensional, but it's the essence of who this guy is. And it is really just to that he doesn't like these people, and doesn't like their pride, and doesn't like that they can't see that they're superior, and, you know, the Cardassians were superior. And, I think that again, that's another great part of this story, is that they just make him, I think in some ways that you may have been able to argue to some degree like, oh, he redeemed himself, he's trying to redeem himself, you know, before. There's no question after this episode, I don't think.
He talks about the Bajorans. I thought it was good that he said we were a century ahead of them, because on the surface, of course, a century sounds like, wow, we're really advanced. But actually, typically in Star Trek or science fiction, if you have two different planets like this, the groups are going to be many, many, many hundreds of years, many centuries more advanced, or a millennium advanced. But here on Earth, we have cultures that are essentially a century more advanced than other cultures. So it actually was something that can put it into context for us, where we can think about, you know, say us as the United States, as one of the most technologically advanced countries, versus some cultures in Africa or South America or somewhere that haven't had a technological revolution. And they really are, you know, 100 years behind us technologically. And then if we were to go in and say, you know, we're superior, these people should bow before us, we're just going to wipe them out because they're not worthy. And of course, we wouldn't do that. But making it only a century, in Descartes' head, it's like some great advancement, but it really isn't. Especially not for, you know, the Bajorans, they had space flight thousands of years ago, right? So it wasn't like they were a primitive society.
Well, I think that was one of the great parts of this episode that's tucked away, is this underseated Cardassian racism, their superiority complex. They really have had it inbred in them. And this is actually playing out still in the novels. Now I'm reading David R. George III's newest novel, Revelations and Dust. And this is still happening in Cardassians then. And so this is, you know, 10, 15 so years after the end of Deep Space Nine. Cardassians are still struggling with this idea of their superiority complex and trying to rid themselves of that, and how difficult it is once it's been so ingrained for so long. And this deep-seated racism they had about against everybody, but specifically for them against the Bajorans, it really mirrors that what we see with you know, Nazi Germany and the Jews and Gypsies and that kind of superiority complex, or you know, between slave owners and their slaves here in the States. I mean, all of those horrible things we think of,
and you still see that today towards Gypsies in Europe. You know, the past, you know, with the Jews or others we may feel like that's kind of past history now. We're kind of moving beyond it. But the Gypsies are a good example, because, you know, there's still great prejudice against that group in Europe that lingers in this way, like the Cardassians here.
Yeah. So I think that that's a really interesting thing, that this deep-seated belief, you know, really drives everything that's behind this kind of revelation that Dukat makes at the end, that I just wish I had killed them all. It's this root at the bottom, which is, I believe that I'm superior, therefore I should be able to do whatever I want to these people, because they're not as valuable as I am. And that's a very dangerous road to be on, and I love that. Again, you know, Star Trek here is we talked about before, in the middle of the postmodern craze, is saying no, there's a definite difference between what's really good and what's actually evil, and we've seen it again. You know, this is touching on, we've seen this problem in the 20th century. So you need to remember it, or you're going to get lost. You're going to forget it, and you're going to repeat it. And I think we kind of seen some of those things repeated. You know, talking about what in Europe, that feeling towards the Gypsies there, even still towards Jews today, and whatnot. It's just a dangerous mentality to have. And so I like that Star Trek is teaching us this just isn't appropriate. It's not right. There is a definite right. There's a definite wrong here. And one of these things is not like the other.
I was thinking like of, especially what you guys are talking about now, but the thing that I liked about Deep Space Nine is when, just in the setup, the entire conceptualization, even before the show is on the air, is, you know, okay, so you have this space station out in the middle of nowhere. And I think the obvious thing to do is to go in the route of sort of treating it like it's a Western. And there is flavors of that, right? There's a constable and things like that. But they never, I don't think they ever really go a long way with that metaphor. It, the metaphor they chose instead, I think, was to do, you know, this World War II metaphor. And if you really read Deep Space Nine that way, you know, now you have the bar, right? That's the bar where that's the officer's mess, you know, in a World War II, you know, even whether movie or reality, you know. And if you really treat it that way, you know, the whole story, I think, could be read in a different way than thinking of it as, you know, science fiction or whatever, but it's using the trappings of World War II trappings. And so, you know, whereas something like Babylon 5, which had a similar location, I think did embrace more the sort of Western, you know, theme or whatever. Star Wars embraces, you know, the Western idea in science fiction. But Star Trek, this was a little more of a World War II motif. And I think, you know, certainly the Bajorans, when they were created on Next Gen, I think, you know, they could have stood for Armenians. I mean, they could, there's a lot of groups that they could have stood for, but somehow on Deep Space Nine, you know, I just never saw it as anything other than a metaphor between the Jewish population and in Germany and then the Nazi party, and then just the way that the Cardassians are set up and their look and their, you know, the fact that everyone dresses the same, you know, in that culture almost. I think that's what makes the show kind of interesting, is that it, because in some ways you expected the show to deal with, which may show our limitations, I think our limitations, or maybe just my own limitation. But, you know, I presumed, well, okay, now that we have an African-American captain, we're going to be dealing with issues like racism more on the show and so on. Again, that may show my own mental limitations, but in some ways they said, no, we're going to go broader with this. We're going to look at prejudice and discrimination on a larger palette, which would include, you know, racial discrimination, but also things like religious discrimination and so on. And I think by setting it in that sort of World War II motif, it allowed Deep Space Nine to really explore the social issues in a much more archetypal way, and that would have been, I think, a little more expected if it had been a sort of a Western motif.
Well, it gets at that. I think in a lot of ways it gives it, again, that very classical mythological feel, what you see in a lot of mythology. It reminds me, honestly, of a lot of how you see kind of good and evil and everything played out in The Lord of the Rings. It's very much like that. There's a clear distinction between the two. And, you know, by the end, it's very apparent. So, I really see that as being a strength to the series because it helps it transcend, you know, just one time period. And I think, you know, we may have talked about this before, and I've, you know, a lot of fans have talked about this, but, you know, in a lot of ways, TNG will always kind of be stuck in an 80s motif. And a lot of the issues that they deal with, because they deal with it in that very kind of like postmodern therapy type culture. But Deep Space Nine takes itself and elevates itself above the 90s, really, and gives it an archetypal feel, which will make it transcend for a lot longer. I mean, you know, even TOS falls into that because it's very much in the frame of the 60s. But Deep Space Nine, I think, does such a good job of putting itself above those things so that you can watch it and really continue to appreciate it as it goes. And for me, this is why, again, this is my favorite of the Star Trek series, because I can watch it and I'm getting out of it something that's more than just kind of a lesson I might have learned at the time. In fact, again, I'm reading David's book and he's reusing the scene from Emissary where Sisko is experiencing linear time as he's trying to teach the prophets, but he's realizing that he's stuck in linear time. and where he's stuck is this horrible place of his wife dying. And it was, I was literally crying at work in the scene, because it's so beautiful. And what it's teaching you is that we in life can, you know, get stuck in these places that are horrible, and we kind of live in these moments instead of living where we are, moving forward and learning and growing and changing, and what it means to be part of a linear existence. And these are the things that Deep Space Nine does, because it's moving the story beyond just where we were at the time the show is being made. It's telling us big, broad tales that can teach us something really big, because it's about all of humanity at all points in time, not just one. And that's brilliant, amazing storytelling. And I just got on the soapbox, but that's okay, because this is The Orb and I can do that.
You just opened the orb and it made you say that. That's all.
It's exactly what happened. I just had an orb experience. I apologize to the listeners.
No, it's a good orb experience.
It was
the orb of wisdom.
Well, guys, we've been talking about this for almost an hour, so I think we could go on for a long time, but we should probably wrap up. Are there any final thoughts that you guys have about Sisko, Dukat, what happens in this episode?
Well, you know what I'd like to see? I know it's kind of sounds weird, but where they were doing those fan collective, you know, DVDs for a while and so on. And I know that, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with DS9 and Blu-ray. And you know, I'm hoping that we're going to see the same type of wonderful thing with that we're seeing with the TNG. But if they can't.
I think we will.
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. If they can't, or it's too expensive, I'd love to see like a fan collective of Dukat episodes where we see this arc. I mean, you could almost sort of, I think he's in 35 episodes or something like that. You know, you could sort of take the 12 best episodes and you know, put them in a collection. And, you know, if they had to do a Blu-ray, it'd be great, and clean up the effects and all that. But the... this episode, I think, in some ways, is the most important of the Dukat episodes. And, you know, so would certainly be on that collection. So I think, you know, if there's a defining episode for him, it's this one. I think in many ways, you know, maybe a little bit of the one with his daughter, too. But this episode is such a great episode because it takes the character and, you know, crystallizes who he is. So that's what I always appreciated about it.
Could you imagine being in the theater for the 6-part beginning of season 6? You know, that's what they do for
straight
for
through.
My gosh, just straight through. I'd totally love it. I mean, you'd have to have an intermission, but it would just be fantastic. You know, I think when I watch this episode, what really strikes me is that the direction Rene directs this episode, and he does such a fantastic job of staging everything and getting the characters just right. And like you said, Chris, it really is very much a stage play, but you're not paying attention to any of that, you know, at all, because you're just so enraptured with the acting abilities that you're being shown. And these two guys really pull you in. And in any time, you know, even when they pull out to the Defiant or to Deep Space Nine, I never felt like, oh no, I have to get back to the cave, because everybody's really putting on a great show this episode. Like, they're just all on, I felt like, watching the characters and the serious nature of everything, and just kind of the melancholy of, like you were talking about earlier, Chris, they're being in this war and this melancholy that's just kind of strung over them. I think it all plays so well, and I think it goes with the direction. And that's one of the things that for me really stood out is watching the episode and really appreciating as I watch it over and over again, is there's always something new.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you guys. This is a defining episode for Dukat and for Sisko. It's a turning point, sets up from here on out to the end of the series, what happens with them, the celestial battle. And it's, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, maybe not for Niners, but for general fans who maybe aren't Niners, it's one of those episodes. It's kind of like Shuttlepod 1 on Enterprise, where it's two guys and it's so talky that some people might kind of feel like, I want to pass this and get on to the next exciting episode. But boy, this is just, I think, quintessential Deep Space Nine. right here. So I really love this episode. All right. Well, John, I really appreciate you joining us tonight and just really very, very interesting angles that you had on Cisco and Ducat here. Some stuff we've never really touched on before. And that was wonderful. So I really appreciate you taking time out for us tonight.
Thanks, guys. It was great. And give me a whole new set of the ideas to think about. So, and I have more to watch. Thanks.
So before we let you go, tell us what you got coming up. Tell people where they can find you if they want to talk to you more or, you know, follow some of your Trek stuff or non-Trek stuff that you're doing.
Sure. The easiest way is on Twitter. It's just J Tenuto. So J-T-N-U-T-O. Just last night we gave a presentation at a local library here about the making of The Wrath of Khan, and we should have an article in the next day or two up at StarTrek.com, which will be our third part of our continuing article series on the making of Space Seed, and then eventually that'll morph into the making of Wrath of Khan. It was kind of a way to get some of this information out to people who can't make the talks, and the great thing is last night we played some sound files of scenes that were filmed and have never been shown before that we got from an Italian fan. So it was really great to share that with the audience, and they could kind of hear the Khan baby scene. They could hear it.
Oh, wow.
It was really cool. So at least parts of it, and that was really fun. And next week I'm doing a talk, if anybody's interested, believe it or not, on the history of the Lone Ranger. But I'm going to be talking about DeForest Kelly because he plays a role in that too. And that's going to be at the Aspen Library, part of the Cook Memorial Library. So if people just check out the Cook Memorial Library in Libertyville, if they're interested, we're going to do a really fun presentation that looks at the 80-year history of the Lone Ranger.
Wow, 80 years. My goodness. It's amazing how far back some of these series go. Well, that sounds fascinating. So everyone, you know, go check out John's stuff. And again, John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, Matthew, it was just a great discussion with John. It's always fascinating when he's on with us. But, you know, this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Aliens of Deep Space Nine.
That's a really good question. I honestly never even thought to question the Vorta's idea of their own existence and whether or not it was, you know, just a story.
Earl Grey.
The 1701D.
So correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a little while since I've seen Generations, but is it possible also that before it was used as stellar cartography, it might have been Cerebro?
The Ready Room.
Homefront and Paradise Lost.
See, that's the kind of guy I want to vote for. Yeah. If he says, I don't want to do this, please don't vote for me, that job looks really hard, I'm going to go, I like this guy.
To the journey!
Collective commentary.
Right, no. The Borg does okay. not...
They don't do not create like that. They All have right. to assimilate.
Because that I just thought was strange. Like, okay, so one of the people they assimilated was pregnant, or... Okay.
Commentary, Trek stars.
Roswell.
And that was what Kadams was going for in season one. He saw it as more of a metaphor than anything. He didn't really care about the actual science fiction behind it. And he said that he got a note from a network exec which just said, aliens, aliens, aliens.
Warp 5.
The Sphere Builders.
And it is a good concept. I think and obviously the reasons it was introduced were more because of the studio and wanting that looking forward perspective, you know, getting ahead of the 24th century.
Trek news and views.
Who watches the watchers?
Which also brings into question Dr. Crusher, because, you know, Pulaski can put a new heart in him, but Beverly Crusher can't even heal an arrow wound.
Literary Treks.
Assignment Earth Comics.
I kind of liked it in that it picks up from Assignment Earth, the Star Trek episode, where we find out that Gary Seven has been sent there to find out why the two agents who were supposed to be stopping that missile launch can't do it. What happened to them?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can download or stream from the website. We have many, many ways for you to get our shows, so go check them all out, and you can find links to everything on our website at trek.fm/pd. And Matthew, I believe last show we had an iTunes review, and we have a couple of other ones this week that I wanted to share. And the first one is from WeatherServo9. Now, Matthew, am I right? Was it Literary Treks where we talked about WeatherServo9 last time?
You know, I believe it is.
I think it was. So WeatherServo9 also left us a review for The Orb, and he says, thoughtful show, thoughtful discussion, 5 stars. I'm a Trek FM fanboy, he says, and proudly so. He or she, I actually don't know if WeatherServo is male or female, but DS9 was the most thoughtful of the Trek shows, so it deserves the most thoughtful discussions. Chris and Matt fearlessly delve into whatever topics and characters DS9 presented us with, and they do so intelligently, passionately, and respectfully. They should double the price they're charging for this great content. I think that's a good idea, Matthew. What's double of nothing? So we appreciate that very much, WeatherServo. Thank you for all your reviews and for listening to our shows, and glad that you're enjoying The Orb. We really do try to approach DS9 the way the writers approach the topics there, which is to give them the respect and the diverse analysis that they deserve. So we're glad that you're enjoying that. Also, we have a review from Gary4278, who I believe left us a review for The Ready Room this past week as well. And Gary says, great show, 5 stars. Chris and Matt do a great job hosting this DS9 show. Witty and insightful. A must listen for any DS9 fans. So again, Gary, we really appreciate those kind words. And to everyone else, please drop by iTunes. Again, we don't generally ask people to do this that often on the shows, but we would really appreciate it if you do enjoy The Orb. Drop by iTunes, take 30 seconds or a minute, leave us a star rating and a written review. It actually does help other fans find the show as they search in iTunes for Star Trek podcasts and Deep Space Nine podcasts. And we love hearing from you as well, so please do that. And you know, also, if you want to send us a message, you can go to the website, trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show, choose The Orb. That will come to Matthew and me both by email. You can also use the tab on the right-hand side of any page to send us a voicemail by using your webcam's microphone, and you can upload it to us. And then in social media, you'll find us over on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and also on Twitter. We're always tweeting about Star Trek under username trekfm. And Matthew, when you're not, you know, trying to get your soup just right, get the right amount of salt in that soup, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, tweeting about all sorts of whatever. Yeah, just minutia. I mean, that's really what Twitter is, right? And so,
it really is.
And then I do, I am with you, as we were talking about just a second ago, on the Literary Treks, books and comics. We do that. If you enjoy the Deep Space Nine talk that we had here, we're actually going to be continuing our Deep Space Nine relaunch soon. We got some other great things coming up with authors and whatnot, so very exciting there. And then, of course, I do have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com, so you can check me out there. Doing things that really unrelated to Star Trek most of the time, but just my own personal taste. So if you just wanted to know more about me, you can check me out there. Chris, when you emerge from that cave that you've been hiding in, where can we maybe check you out online?
You can find me in sick bay talking to Jadzia with one of those cool little things on my forehead like they used on Chekhov in The Voyage Home. A little more advanced. Now, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere on social media under that same username. And like you, Matthew, I do have my own website as well. It's cbrianjones.com, which I'm trying very hard to update. But, you know, it's taking me some time with all these podcasts we're doing, taking me some time to get over there to do that. But you can check that out, you know, if you want to find out what I do outside of Star Trek, music and all sorts of other stuff. So you can find me over there. And besides the shows we do together, Matthew, on Tuesdays, you can find me on The Ready Room, where you are with me sometimes. And on The Ready Room, we're joined by hosts from all across the network, as well as special guests. John is there with us occasionally as well. And we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series and Star Trek news. And then on Fridays, I'm with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where just like we talk about Deep Space Nine here on The Orb, on Warp 5, we talk about Star Trek Enterprise exclusively. And we also interview a lot of people involved in the creation of Star Trek. So check that out as well. Also, Matthew, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsor for this week's show. Your support of our sponsor is very important to helping us bring The Orb to you every week. And that sponsor is Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it easy for you to create a beautiful blog, a website, a portfolio, an online store, anything you can imagine, really. It's really a fantastic system. I've used them for 6 years myself. Trek FM is built on Squarespace. You won't find any better way to build your online presence. And best of all, you can try them free for 14 days. Import your existing website from WordPress or wherever you have it. Find out how those tools make it possible for you to create an exceptional website. And as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using offer code TREK9. And you can get it all by going to squarespace.com. Again, use offer code TREK9. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of The Orb. Also, if you'd like to support what we're doing at Trek FM, you can do that by going to trek.fm/donate. We have 8 different alien illustrations there. They're available as badges or larger art prints, and you can choose which ones you want, mix and match. We have different levels of contributions that you can make, so choose the ones that's right for you. Let us know which aliens you would like, and we'll get those over to you right away. And your donations make it possible for us to cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring all of our shows to you every week. So we really appreciate your support.
We'd like to thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.